Hello to all our listeners, and welcome to the July 15th Red Journal podcast. It is always so great to hear from our truly remarkable radiobiology section. And today I've got one of our section editors, Dr. Henning Willers, associate professor at Harvard Medical School and director of translational radiation research at Mass General Brigham, here to help me welcome our guest, Dr. Pippa Kasper from the University of Wisconsin. Dr. Kasper is joining us to discuss an article generated during her postdoctoral time in Dr. Beth Weaver's laboratory, which was published as an article in this month's issue called Pretreatment Chromosomal Instability. We're going to talk about that. It's called CIN, correlates with radiation sensitivity in squamous cell cancers. So, Dr. Willers, this article was published in our rigorously vetted biology section. Tell us why your section found this paper novel and exciting.
Thank you, Dr. It is great to be here with you and Dr. Kasper and doing this. And yes, so let's just maybe start with just talking a little bit about chromosomal instability or CIN or SIN, which is a form of genomic instability, which is quite common in human cancers as it promotes things like tumor evolution, adaptation, and survival. And SIN may also come with an increased ability to cope with and repair DNA damage, which then could be associated with radiation resistance. And that's, how we traditionally thought of chromosomal instability. And in fact, in patients with tumors that feature signs or signatures of chromosomal instability, there have been reports of poor outcomes after radiation therapy. So with that, this work was really, fascinating to us as it put forth a new paradigm that chromosomal instability may actually result in increased rather than reduced sensitivity to radiation. And so, Dr. Kasper's study was also quite rigorous in that it integrated multiple cancer cell lines, including isogenic pairs with patient-derived xenografts and patient-derived biopsies to convincingly associate differences in SIN present at baseline, that means before any treatment starts, with radiation responses. And so, yeah, we were quite interested in that. And lastly, as you know, in the biology section of the journal, we do prioritize experimental findings that have direct clinical translation potential. And our field remains in need of actionable biomarkers that guide radiation use and dosage. And baseline chromosomal instability or SIN could potentially fit that bill. But it may also not be as simple as it sounds.
Absolutely. And so, if I'm understanding you, Dr. Willers, you're saying that sometimes SIN is associated with radiation resistance, and sometimes SIN is associated with radiation sensitivity. So that's what I think our agenda is today, is to try to understand that. And Dr. Kasper, maybe you could just start by explaining to us in more depth, what is SIN, chromosomal instability? And historically, I think there's a term called aneuploidy. It would be good to know how SIN is different from aneuploidy. And finally, your paper describes a few different sources of SIN. Maybe you could explain to the listenership how SIN is actually generated in a cancer.
Yes, absolutely. First, I just want to start by thanking you for inviting me and having this amazing opportunity. So, you asked excellent questions, as this can be quite confusing. And I think this has to do with how you define chromosomal instability. So, a lot of the older studies that looked at kind of complexity of genomes termed that genomic instability, and indeed they can be associated with radiation resistance. In my work, we are specifically referring to SIN as a continuous rate of chromosome missegregation that occurs over multiple cell divisions. So essentially, we're focusing solely on rate of chromosome missegregation. And this is very different than aneuploidy, which is a consequence of SIN, right? If you missegregate multiple chromosomes, the daughter cells are going to have an abnormal chromosome number. However, aneuploid cells can be chromosomally stable. So that is a very important thing to make sure that we differentiate. So aneuploidy is a hallmark of cancer. And aneuploid cells are indeed associated with radiation resistance. But again, Aneuploid cells do not necessarily have sin. So in my work, we engineered cells to have higher levels of chromosome missegregation in order to prove that it's the actual act of missegregation causing this effect. And chromosomal instability is indeed very common in most solid tumor types, and there are many sources of chromosomal instability or causes. Among those include alterations in mitotic checkpoint genes. You can have alterations in kinetochore microtubule attachments, as well as microtubule dynamics. Replication stress can cause it, defects in DNA damage. There are multiple things that cause this in tumor cells.
Thank you for that wonderful teaching. And one of the terms I found so interesting and amusing was the term genetic chaos, which I think you've really explained to me now with the difference from aneuploidy, which, as you're saying, could be stable. So, very helpful starting explanation there on chromosomal instability with emphasis on the term instability. So, let's go back to our agenda, which was talking about radiation resistance. Dr. Willers, you pointed out when you started that sin has traditionally been associated with radiation resistance. And you had pointed out that there is a historical association there that is quite different than what Dr. Cosper's group was proposing. So, maybe you could just tell me very briefly what major evidence or argumentation did Dr. Cosper's group present that convinced you that the hypothesis that sin could produce greater radiation sensitivity might actually be valid, as that is so different than what was historically thought?
Yeah, great question. Thank you. I'd say that the one approach that Dr. Cosper and her team took that was quite compelling was to determine whether baseline sins, so before any treatment, was associated with differences in radiation sensitivity response using several approaches and endpoints. So that included several cell lines used in vitro, it included patient-derived xenografts, and on top of that, tumor biopsies from patients with head and neck cancer who had undergone radiation therapy and for whom local tumor control outcomes were available. And so she and her team demonstrated for these three endpoints that there was a very clear and consistent association between higher levels of sin at baseline and greater radiation sensitivity in these different readouts. So that was compelling, but of course, correlation does not necessarily imply causation. So they also created two isogenic cell pairs and induced higher sin levels by genetically manipulating the status of a mitotic checkpoint protein, which then led to increased chromosomal missegregation events and radio sensitivity. So that's a mechanistic evidence and not just correlation to support that association. And so taking that all together, we felt that was quite compelling.
So maybe Dr. Willers, you could explain to me then why is sin traditionally associated with radiation resistance? Are we discounting that historical association completely?
I'm really inclined, if I may, to give that question directly back to Dr. Cosper.
Okay, Dr. Cosper, maybe you could explain to us then why this traditional association of sin with radiation resistance isn't true. Are we completely discounting that, or is it still true in some circumstances more narrowly?
So I think that it has to do in how one defines sin. So none of the previous methods to quantify sin have been what we used, which is actual quantification of chromosome missegregation during mitosis. A lot of those prior studies are based on whole genome sequencing, complexity of genomes, and again, that is a single state of a tumor at a single time. And all of those complex genomes, I have no doubt, are associated with radiation resistance, usually in the presence of mutant P53, I might add. And so all of those past ways to quantify sin are very different than the way that we have quantified sin. Thus, I think the difference lies in how you define it and how you quantify it.
Fantastic. That's so clear. And maybe to elaborate on that further, so Dr. Cosper, how do you go about identifying if there is sin in a tumor? Your paper actually proceeded on the basis of a so-called, if I'm getting this right, maximally tolerated threshold of sin that would result in greater radiation sensitivity. So that implies that sin is quantifiable. And if so, how do you establish this critical threshold experimentally and demonstrate that it's been exceeded?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'm just going to start with the basis for our hypothesis and the principle. So if a cell missegregates a couple chromosomes, which is very normal for a cancer cell, usually the daughter cells can survive that. However, if a cell loses, for example, five or more chromosomes upon mitosis, the daughter cells are likely to have lost one or both copies of essential chromosomes and they will die. And so that is the principle behind this. If we increase sin to such high levels where we exceed the maximally tolerated threshold of chromosome loss, daughters will die. Daughter cells will die. And we know that radiation is an excellent inducer of sin. And so therefore the principle is that cells with already pretty high sin at baseline are going to be more sensitive to radiation because they're more easily pushed over that maximally tolerated threshold to their death. Quantifying sin is chromosome missegregation. I'm going to define that again, is a quite laborious process because of the definition. So, in vitro, we actually count and quantify the percentage of cells that are missegregating chromosomes during both metaphase and anaphase. And we can also do this in murine tumors or human tumors if the tumor sample is large enough and contains enough mitotic cells. For example, we usually count about 50 cells in each phase of mitosis to get an accurate idea of the chromosome missegregation rates or sin. However, in human tumors, many biopsies are tiny and might contain only one or two mitotic cells. And then we have to use a different method, which is also in this manuscript called six chromosome FISH, which is basically a readout for sin. We use fluorescence in situ hybridization for the probes of six different centromeres. We then count how many copies of each chromosome are in about 20 to 30 cells. We get a modal number for each chromosome. So again, this is more indicative of that part is aneuploidy. However, we can from that number calculate the percent of cells with non-modal chromosomes, which is indicative of how often these chromosomes are shuffled between the cells during mitosis. And then that is our readout of sin in human tumors.
Just out of curiosity, Dr. Willers, could you see something like that actually being used in the clinic? Or is that just too complex?
It does sound sophisticated, I might say. But yes, I think there's potential. I mean, it's of course it's a long road from, taking a research assay to having it standardized in a clear certified lab. But I think it's very appealing.
If I might add, it actually is highly translatable. So this is the same FISH assay that the hospital labs do with HER2 staining, for example. And we actually use the hospital lab for this assay. It's the quantification bit that is quite time consuming and takes some learning, but we're already working with a company to try and get this faster with artificial intelligence. And so hopefully one day it can be, if obviously further validated, can be easily used for diagnostic purposes.
Oh, that's exciting. You dropped a few key catchphrases there. Maybe we've got some VCs listening. Dr. Willers, so the other part of the paper that was kind of interesting had to do with docetaxel and taxanes. And this is where I think some of the translation came in. These are commonly known to operate through mitotic arrest. Dr. Cosper's experiments, again, quite revolutionary in a way. We're aiming to show that the mechanism of docetaxel's radiosensitization could actually be explained through sin. So maybe you could explain this a little bit, and then Dr. Cosper can answer some other questions I have about that.
Yeah, good question. I'll give that an honest try, I think. Part of the paper provided actually another level of evidence and support of sin causing radiosensitivity. So, I mean, let us back up for a second. So classically, taxanes such as paclitaxel and docetaxel have been thought to cause radiosensitization through arresting cancer cells in mitosis, which, as we all know, is the most radiosensitive phase of the cell cycle. And then subsequently, that would induce cells to suffer mitotic catastrophe and die. And that has been assumed to be likely the dominant form of radiosensitization when you combine taxanes with radiation. But Dr. Cosper and her team raised the possibility that that's not correct. And in fact, the biological effects may be concentration dependent. So depending on the concentration of docetaxel. Now, that opens, I would say, a little bit of a can of worms, because it is actually very difficult to model chemotherapy effects in the lab, just because the way how chemotherapy is given in the clinic is very different from the way we give biologics, where patients can take a pill every day and you get pretty steady levels of chemotherapy, and you give it weekly, you know, you get a high peak immediately. So for docetaxel, I think the plasma concentration in the first 24 hours, well, the first, the highest in the first few hours, and then the next 24 hours, they're a little lower, but still sort of in the, I think, and Dr. Cosper, correct me if I'm wrong, somewhere in the 10 to 100 nanomolar range. And then, you know, it goes down further, and there's probably a concentration of in the low nanomolar range for several days. So there is likely going to be quite a mix of biological effects happening in the patient. And then on top of that, it's not really the plasma concentration of the chemo agent that counts. It's what happens in tumor tissue, and it happens so that docetaxel actually accumulates in tumor tissues over time. And so the concentration then will be higher again. So it's potentially complicated. So at higher concentrations, I think we all expect to see the classical mechanism of the taxan effect, to see a mitotic arrest and mitotic catastrophe. And at lower concentration, Dr. Cosper and her team showed that quite well, you see something different. You see the absence of mitotic arrest, and you see multipolar spindles, which when the cell attempts to divide, that leads to lethal cell divisions. And so then experimentally, they showed very convincingly, I think, in vitro, that at low doses of docetaxel, that caused only those multipolar spindles, but not mitotic arrest, that could lead to radiosensitization. And they also observed quite similar effect in a tumor growth delay assay in mice, although not entirely clear to me whether the data really shows that there's a synergistic effect. Maybe it's a bit more additive, but clearly taking it together, it in a potential revolutionary way, as you hinted at, that there may be a very different mechanism of radiosensitization going on in support of the overall hypothesis that SYN is actually a major determinant of radiosensitivity. Dr. Cosper, did I get that right? And what experiments do you think, you know, this is just the beginning, I think, but what experiments really need to be done still to more definitively demonstrate that taxane-induced SYN is the dominant radiosensitizing mechanism in patients with head and neck and other cancers?
Thank you, Dr. Willers. Yes, that was an excellent summary. I'm just going to start by answering this, that these studies were based off of Dr. Weaver's work in her group studying the mechanism of paclitaxel in breast cancer. And so this was kind of extrapolated from this. So she actually ran a study from patients where they treated breast cancer patients with the standard dose of paclitaxel. This occurred both with a Q3 week, 175 milligrams per meter squared, as well as weekly 80 milligrams per meter squared doses. And then they took a breast tumor biopsy 20 hours after paclitaxel infusion and found a significant increase in multipolar spindles, but no change in mitotic arrest. And this correlated with patient response to the drug. And so I wanted to know if this is what was happening with docetaxel in head and neck cancer. And so the doses that we picked were extrapolated from her studies. And you are correct. I don't think anyone knows the actual intratumoral dose of or concentration of docetaxel in head and neck tumors. And I think that would be a critical next step to show that this is actually happening in patients. Of course, this is extremely difficult because this requires patients to undergo additional biopsies, which is a big ask for many patients. But ideally, we would treat them with a therapeutic dose of docetaxel, 24 hours later, take a core biopsy of the primary tumor, and then we can look for the multipolar spindles and quantify mitotic arrest in that tissue. In terms of the murine studies, I think to be more convincing, we would have to do a whole concentration range, right? I showed this effect with very low concentration of docetaxel, but with higher, of course, we would see a better radiosensitization effect. And potentially with very high concentrations, we would indeed see mitotic arrest, which does happen with high concentrations of docetaxel. So I think doing a concentration curve, I think, would be ideal in determining what actually is going on and what is responsible for the radiosensitization in vivo.
I have a few sort of instant reactions to this as a person who does head and neck cancer in my clinical life. And one is, I think this is totally fascinating that you've taken a mechanism that you really developed as an explanation for radiosensitization, and you're now applying it as well to chemotherapy as a sort of, more universal explanation for how all of these modalities operate. That's just very interesting. But the second thing I think about is, we always are focused on how low radiation dose may be different than high radiation dose. And I've never really thought about that in the context of chemotherapy. It could be, as Dr. Will is just pointing out, that low dosing of taxane may be very different than high dosing of taxane. And as you know, Dr. Cosper, in head and neck cancer, this is really a primary question where we continually confront the age-old question of cisplatin given every 3 weeks versus cisplatin given weekly. So just wondering about your response to some of those thoughts. And also, I do have, some questions about whether you think that docetaxel, if we were to extend this whole very complicated analogy out, would docetaxel in combination with radiation work differently than docetaxel in combination with cisplatin, given all of these factors? Or do you think they're really just operating through the same mechanism of sin?
Those are great questions, which I can't fully answer, but I will say we are starting a lot of experiments with cisplatin because, to my surprise, no one has ever quantified SYN after cisplatin in terms of quantifying mitotic errors in cells. And we've been finding some really, really interesting findings. Mostly these cells have a significant number of chromosome bridges. We're talking 4 to 5 bridges per cell at very low cisplatin concentration. So that's pretty high SYN. And so again, we are currently working on showing that that is another main mechanism of radiosensitization, also by engineering cells that just have bridges through different mechanisms so that you can kind of take the cisplatin, drug out of that equation. Combining chemotherapies, I can't really answer because I mostly study radiation. I think radiation does a lot of damage, right? And some of those low dose chemotherapies might not cause enough damage to ultimately induce cell death. And so I think having a chemotherapy to induce low levels of SYN is kind of just the amount you might need to push cells over that maximally tolerated threshold in combination with radiation.
That's interesting. So they're kind of additive in a way. Like you think basically they're all contributing more and more sin.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a very different way of thinking about it, than the sort of typical way we think about radiosensitization. Any comments on this, Dr. Willers? Are you buying
I'm buying more. So I'm in hesitation mode. It is awfully difficult, I think, to, as I already mentioned before, to model chemo effects in the lab to explain what we do in patients. In patients, as you know, we dose by tolerance mostly, or almost exclusively. And again, we have this issue with the chemotherapy that the concentrations are over time all over the place with probably different biological effects. And how do you model it in the lab? I have to say, Dr. Cosmo, not to throw cold water on your experiments, but I personally, as a, it's a very subjective choice, but I've really tried to stay away from using cisplatin, especially, in vitro experiments. So I don't know. I think this is difficult, but it's also an exciting challenge. Just because it's been difficult in the past, that doesn't mean that we should avoid it. And I think those are really, because we have now translatable mechanisms here that are novel, I think it's really worth taking another look at how we can have a more rational design of radiation and chemotherapy schedules in patients, which we haven't yet. We don't even know whether we should give the radiation, what the sequence is, whether, with weekly infusions, do we give radiation before, after? So there's a lot to be discovered to help us, optimize our treatment schedules.
Yeah, they do seem like very complex experiments, and you'd have to work out sort of the timing in a very intricate way. But these are very basic questions in the clinic all the time, as we talked about. And, speaking of translational relevance in the clinic, Dr. Cosper, your paper does a really great job of explaining how these experiments really do have implications for real-world treatment of head and neck cancer in particular. And I think this became most evident in your experiments on the laryngeal cancer samples that were treated with definitive radiation. But I was a little bit puzzled when I got to the part where you described that the CIN results were not that clearly different between the laryngeal cancers that recurred and the ones that did not recur. And reading a little bit more deeply, if I understood, it said that these had to be defined in terms of their CIN relative to each other as being above or below the median. So it seems like in those samples, although I know there weren't very many, it was difficult to quantify a CIN cutoff score. And I just wondered if you could comment on that and whether that could limit the future applicability of this as a biomarker.
Yes, there were many limitations to this small clinical study. There were only 29 samples, which is a very small amount. And additionally, there were many different anatomic tumor sites. The chemotherapies were different, the stages were different. So it was, I think, honestly, way too of a heterogeneous population to gather many strong conclusions, but it was kind of all we had to work with at the moment. And it gave some signal that patients with CIN above the median, i.e., high CIN, had a much better response to definitive chemoradiation. The good news is, my group has already validated this in a much cleaner cohort. So we're working on this paper now. This was presented at ASTRO, I think 2 years ago now. But we obtained clinical samples from patients enrolled in RTOG 9512, which was a clinical trial enrolling patients with T2 laryngeal cancer. And this was a fractionation question. So all of these patients were treated with radiation alone, which is a really clean way to look at this because it omits any kind of surgery or chemotherapy that might muddy the waters here. And ultimately, we quantified CIN in 107 of these patients, and the results were cleaner than I ever could have imagined. And so we're very excited to report this soon. But essentially, when you broke up CIN in quartiles, right? So you have the lowest, the highest, and then like the two middle quartiles. All of the patients with CIN in the highest quartile were completely cured with radiation, whereas all local failures occurred in patients with CIN in the lower three quartiles. And so that really does provide evidence that there is a cutoff of quote unquote high CIN. And having a much cleaner, kind of more homogeneous patient population has been much better to prove this point.
Well, that's a fantastic sample to test your hypotheses on, and one I happen to be pretty familiar with. Just curious, and this is a little bit of a trail off the main pathway here, but you're aware that the NRG has done analyses on KEAP1 in that same sample. Any thoughts about how CIN and KEAP1 could be interacting? Because the KEAP1 was also pretty predictive.
Yes, great question. So Dr. Quinn Lee and I have worked together, and we've already done a sub-analysis combining all of our data. And there were about 80 patients in common between her study and my study. I'm not going to give away the result yet because we are writing the paper and that has not yet been presented. But yes, we have worked together and combined our data, and that will be in this paper.
That is super exciting. And obviously, we really need more progress for T2 laryngeal cancers, which was the clinical subject of that study. So it would be wonderful to make some progress on that 20 years later after that study was designed. Thank you for doing that. So, Dr. Cosper, next question. One of the stated motivations of your paper was to find means to select patients that could be de-intensified for radiation therapy. And as we all know, that remains sort of a holy grail in the head and neck cancer practice. However, you haven't really shown that HPV-associated cancers have a different level of CIN. Do you think that CIN will explain the known radiosensitivity of HPV cancers that we see in the clinic? And if so, could you explain how that would work?
This is such a difficult question and one that I think about all the time, and I think it's a bit complex. So, but I do have some answers. So, HPV itself is known to induce many different types of CIN, and we published a couple years ago that it induces a specific type of CIN called polar chromosomes, where chromosomes are stuck at the spindle poles. However, when I analyzed about 10 tumors each of HPV positive versus HPV negative from patients, There wasn't a difference in total sin, but there was a very wide range of sin within each cancer. It's not that HPV positive cancers have more sin in general and therefore they are more sensitive. However, I do think that within HPV positive cancers, the ones with high sin will be more sensitive. And so, as you know very well, stratifying by HPV alone has not proven to be enough of a biomarker for us to be able to know who we can de-escalate or not. And so we are currently studying whether or not sin within HPV positive tumors can be used as such a biomarker to risk stratify these patients.
That's fantastic. And next question is, sort of going from the very small to the very broad. We've talked a lot about head and neck cancer. Do you think SYN is a phenomenon that would only apply to head and neck squamous cell carcinomas? And I'll ask Dr. Willers to jump in here. I mean, why can't we apply this to lung cancers, Dr. Willers?
I wish I could say I'm already working on a manuscript and I'm going to be submitting soon with Dr. Kaspar, but I don't. I think so. Yeah, I think that's very much hitting the nail on the head. I think it's very appropriate to conclude that this may be a potentially a tumor agnostic phenomenon. I mean, we need the data for that though, but it could be potentially a marker that spans different tumor types. I think it's very exciting. I'm also very excited, if I may throw that in, about Dr. Kasper, what you're doing there, already linking it to KEAP1 and HPV status, which are already, pretty not quite, well, KEAP1 is not quite established, but we're getting there. So linking this to biomarkers that we know have strong predictive value is really exciting. And I really think this will drive the field forward.
Thank you. Yes, that happens to be aim two of my R01, which
All
is being reviewed in 15 days. So fingers crossed for
right.
all of us.
Dr. Cosper seems to have a lot more going on than you and me, Dr.
Okay. Maybe we gotta get back to work.
So I also agree that this is likely applicable to most cancers because no matter what kind of cell you are, if you lose too many chromosomes, you will die. And so we are really, really excited to hopefully be validating this. And actually, lung cancer is next on our list. Of course, we need the funding and the patient samples for this and kind of a more high throughput way to perform this six chromosome FISH. But absolutely, I do think this is applicable to more cancers. And Sam Bakoum back in the mid 2000s actually showed that this was the case in rectal cancer. And so I think there is promise for a lot of other solid tumors treated with radiation therapy.
So, Dr. Kasper, what other clinical means might there be to manipulate SYN in the clinic if we really wanted to try to use this in response to therapy? How do you see that we would actually increase SYN in a given tumor? Or do you see this more as a biomarker that would be used to bin patients into different kinds of treatments? How would we actually try to take something like this forward from a translational perspective?
Yeah, so I think there's two ways to look at this. So for example, if we have a biopsy of a tumor that displays high SYN, obviously with further validation, we can hopefully say this patient can get treated with radiation alone, they can be spared chemotherapy and potentially even be treated with a lower dose of radiation. Conversely, tumor biopsies with lower levels of SYN need additional kind of SYN-inducing treatment to make them more sensitive to radiation. And this is where SYN-inducing drugs come into play. And docetaxel, paclitaxel are good examples of this. There are other drugs, including SEMP-E inhibitors. SEMP-E is a mitotic kinesin that kind of pulls back misaligned chromosomes. And so when it's gone, you have more misaligned chromosomes. MPS1 inhibitors, basically kind of any targeted drug that targets the spindle assembly checkpoint and weakens it and promoting kind of abnormal anaphases have really great potential to increase SYN, to increase it over the maximally tolerated threshold in combination with radiation.
Well, so that's really interesting. Dr. Kasper, may I just throw in a question that came to my mind? We know that taxanes are really good at inducing micronuclei and in having tumors with similar really high levels of SYN. What's your sense as to how much of immune effect could be contributing to the radiosensitivity that we expect to see in patients?
This is a great and important question, as we all know how, critical the immune response is in overall treatment response. Of course, given it is an immune, the immune response, it is very, very complex. And I have, just a few kind of superficial thoughts about this. We have started looking into this, but again, it's extremely complex and not straightforward. So if you have an acute incident that causes an acute kind of episode of sin, so a couple abnormal cell divisions, for example, there have been studies where immune cells, specifically NK cells, can recognize these abnormal cells, and then the immune system will destroy them. However, Sam Bakoum has shown that in contexts of chronic chromosomal instability, which is more indicative of a human tumor, right? It's been evolving over years. It has chronic chromosome segregation. Chronic chromosomal instability is actually inhibitory to the immune system. So you could imagine that tumor cells would want to evade an immune response, right? And so tumor cells have learned to downregulate inflammatory signals promoting an anti-tumor immune response, and they actually upregulate ER stress. And so chronic SIN tumors actually have an immune cold tumor microenvironment, which certainly complicates things. And this is another important thing to mention is the level of SIN, right? This chronic SIN, I can't tell you how high it was, how low it was, but it is certainly there. And so I think for my research, we want very, very high SIN, which is going to lead to cell death, right? And that's an immune independent effect. However, in tumors, they can have low, medium levels of SIN, for example, and those might have significant consequences on the immune response. And this is a whole burgeoning area of research, which is super exciting and something we have just started to look into.
Yeah, and that just really ties into all the other biomarkers you've talked about because they clearly do have connections to immune response as well. So very interesting linkages that could be there. So Dr. Kasper, just thinking big blue sky kind of process here. What do you think about some of the really exciting new radiation modalities like particle therapy or radiopharmaceutical? Does SIN have any applicability as we move into this world where I believe we're going to see a proliferation of modalities and approaches and combinations?
Yes, it's super exciting. And I think, and I hope SIN will continue to play a role in every single modality that does induce chromosomal instability. Our group, thanks to the University of Wisconsin Initiative for Particle Therapy and Theranostics, we are able to perform a lot of experiments with radiopharmaceutical therapy, which is super exciting. And we can perform all of these radioactive experiments and do radioactive microscopy. And it's been super exciting. So we're really working on quantifying SIN in the context of radiopharmaceutical therapy as well, with the hopes that it can be used to treat patients with, more metastatic disease.
So why do you think RPT in particular would be producing this increased SIN? Can you walk us through that a little bit?
Yeah, so radiopharmaceutical therapy, specifically, we're studying lutetium-177. This releases beta particles and low energy gamma rays over prolonged periods of time once it's in the tumor. The radiobiology has been is largely unexplored, and so we're really excited to try and play a role in this. The main difference between that and external beam is, of course, these cells are continually exposed to radiation over days to weeks. And so while lutetium is traditionally known to cause mostly single-stranded DNA breaks, they do accumulate to double-stranded DNA breaks over a short period of time, and therefore cause chromosomal instability or errors in mitosis, because a lot of these fragments lack a centromere, and therefore they cannot attach to microtubules in the spindle pole and are therefore randomly missegregated.
I see. So you think the RPT would actually increase that missegregation phenomenon?
Well, that's complicated. So we are trying to directly compare it to external beam right now. The dosimetry is extremely complicated. So, and it's almost impossible to directly compare these two modalities because the dose rate is just very different. And so we're trying our best. We are not saying that lutetium has higher level induces higher levels of SIN than external beam, however.
That's really fascinating, though. I love the application of radiobiology principles to these really exciting new things coming into our field. So that's really fantastic. And just want to say that this was a really, really exciting conversation. It's just amazing to hear about how radiobiology is kind of coming into the new era. And, of course, one of the fun things I always experience on this podcast is getting to talk about all these super cool new things and how we can apply it to our familiar clinical experiences, which I think you've done to an extraordinary degree, Dr. Cosper. I was so excited to have both of you here today because you're people who articulate that intersection so well. So thank you so much for explaining your beautiful work, Dr. Cosper, and sharing your research vision with us, and Dr. Willers for helping elucidate that so clearly. Really appreciate you being here today.
Dr. Cosper, very inspiring work. Congratulations on your Red Journal paper and all the amazing work that you're doing. I'm really looking forward to see the success of it.
Thank you both so much. Thank you, Dr. Willers, for your support as always, and Dr. Yam for this incredible invitation and opportunity.
This has been a podcast from the Red Journal. The Red Journal is Astra's premier journal for original laboratory and clinical investigations related to radiation oncology, radiation biology, medical physics, and both education and health policy as they relate to the field. As always, I'd remind you that this podcast is for education only and is not a replacement for qualified medical advice. Astra suggests that you seek out the help of a qualified oncology professional for help with specific decisions.